KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Under the new regulations passed in 2008, the government may easily be listening and could retain and disseminate the results of these conversations.
Super delicious, old school taste with a big hunk of coleslaw on rye. It's a delicious sandwich, really fun.
That's what you are, a great white cat. I didn't marry a woman. I married a cat.
Keep it up. Keep it up. You're doing swell.
Some scary voices to think about from old-time radio today. We're also going to get a recommendation for lunch from Sarah Dickerman, who writes sarahdickerman.com for a variety of journals. We're also going to take a look at what's happening with the Supreme Court and a law on surveillance. But we start with the first district in politics. Republican candidate for the first congressional district, John Koster, is drawing criticism for remarks he made about abortion and rape. He was recorded by an activist with Fuse, a progressive organization in Washington state, at a recent fundraiser. In their conversation, John Koster says abortion just puts more violence on a woman's body, and he refers to rape as the rape thing. Emily Hefter is a reporter for the Seattle Times covering the first district congressional race. Emily, thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A little more about where and when was this tape recorded?
So there was a fundraiser on the 28th in Everett, and a Koster supporter asked, or a person at the fundraiser asked John Koster for some details about his position on abortion and was secretly recording his answer.
Is there any evidence the tape was edited?
Well, certainly something before or something afterward could have happened, and I don't know if it was edited in the middle.
But Koster's not denying the statement, is he?
No, his spokesman said that maybe his choice of words was not so hot, but they stand by his position.
In part, this is drawing criticism because it's on The Daily Show that they have an ongoing tally of when Republican candidates seem to say something about rape that gets them in trouble. That's why this is drawing criticism, because they're linking it to those other comments.
Right.
Is it drawing criticism inside the inside either of the campaigns, beyond, for example, beyond Koster's spokesman saying, well, inappropriate use of words, or in the terms of what Susan Delbene's campaign is saying?
Well, John Koster's positions on abortion and other social issues have been something that the Delbene campaign's been trying to highlight throughout this campaign. So this is very timely for them, you know, a week before election day, that this tape would be released and make national news.
How are people responding in the district? Have you heard?
Well, I haven't heard much from people in the district. I mean, certainly it's been picked up nationally, lots of liberal blogs and conservative blogs discussing it today and overnight.
How is this race doing right now? What's your assessment of it? You write about it for the Seattle Times, Emily Hefter, and the politics blog there. What's your thought?
Well, it's a new district. You know, they redrew the first district to be a swing district, and it's very close. It's a very diverse district that runs from the sort of Microsoft suburbs in Redmond and Medina all the way up to the Canadian border. And John Koster and Susan Delbene are two very different candidates, and the race is very close. Two recent polls have shown them within the margin of error.
Now, that's interesting, because when it began, the assumption was that John Koster, because of his name recognition in that district, was going to be further ahead. Is there any analysis of why that might be so close at this point?
Well, you know, he's been an elected official for a long time in Snohomish County and in the 39th Legislative District in the State House, but she has a lot of money. She's a multimillionaire and is willing to self-finance a lot of this race. She's outraised him from donors also, but she's also put almost $3 million of her own money into the race.
And I'm sure we're going to see some ads coming up, because they have been very quick with their ads, the Delbene campaign, I guess, as well as the Koster campaign to some extent. But they both still have enough money to respond if they need to in these last few days?
Yeah, Koster has only been on cable, and so the network TV ads have really been dominated by Delbene and also by some independent expenditures in support of Delbene or against Koster.
And finally, Emily Hester, I mean, this is an interesting district, like you say, a swing district, but in some places, up near the border, for example, out this statement he made might not anger too many of his already existing supporters, would it? They might even rally behind him the way they have in Missouri.
Yeah, well, there are some really pretty conservative parts of this district, and also a lot of parts of the district that know John Koster really well. And this position on abortion isn't new. He's always been a conservative. He's been really consistent in his beliefs about abortion.
Yeah. All right. He's been quoted as saying that he was speaking casually to a supporter, but I guess the problem is that even when you're speaking casually, words count, don't they?
And you never know if you're being recorded in the last 2 weeks of a congressional campaign.
Emily Hefter is a reporter for the Seattle Times. She's covering the 1st District congressional race. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. This is Weekday.
The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments this week in a case that could determine whether the federal government can be sued for wiretapping citizens. We'll get the full story coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Clipper Vacations. Clipper offers daily trips to Victoria, B.C., along with many other Northwest getaways. More information available at clippervacations.com, your Pacific Northwest travel experts.
KUOW and Seattle Children's Theater present Danny, King of the Basement. With his life in transition, Danny's imagination and friendships trump his family's financial struggles. October 18th through November 18th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Heavy rain falling in Seattle, 54 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting clouds and showers all day today, the high getting up to 58. There's just going to be a chance of showers tonight, the low in the upper 40s. It's going to be partly sunny tomorrow, the high reaching 60.
Now let's take a look at what's happening in the Supreme Court and in surveillance. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the oral arguments in the case Clapper v. Amnesty International. The case raises the question of government surveillance on American citizens. What's before the courts this week, though, is not whether the government can wiretap individuals. The court will rule on who has a legal right to file a lawsuit against the government for wiretapping. Garrett Epps is a legal scholar. He is professor of law at the University of Baltimore.
In 2008, the Congress, at the behest of the Bush administration, broadened the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act widely to permit the government to conduct, in essence, wide wholesale spying on so-called foreign intelligence targets, people abroad. The government now has legal authority to intercept their communications, even if that means intercepting phone calls or emails or messages from so-called United States persons, people legally in this country. Clapper resulted because a group of professionals who have reason to be in touch with various foreigners that the government doesn't like, by which I mean journalists, American lawyers, American human rights activists, brought suit on the grounds that they really can't any longer count on the security of their communications with people who are their clients or their sources, because under the new regulations passed in 2008, the government may easily be listening and could retain and disseminate the results of these conversations, even if they involve Americans.
To who?
To anyone in the intelligence community. These records can be retained. They can be disseminated. If, for example, you are a lawyer who represents people who may be defendants in front of a military tribunal, you're trying to get evidence of your client's possible innocence, you're trying to talk to people in that client's home country, the intelligence agencies can be listening and they can store the confidential information that your sources give you.
Garrett Epps is a legal scholar, novelist, and journalist. He is professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Is there precedent for citizens going before the government and saying, look, we want to sue on this issue?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the basic rule is that you can't challenge government surveillance until it is the product of that surveillance is used against you in court. So most wiretapping cases arise because the police listen in on private conversations and arrest people to prosecute them, and then they can challenge the reasonableness of the wiretap. It is extremely hard to get what's called legal standing to challenge surveillance if you can't demonstrate that you yourself have been the subject of the surveillance, and there's case law going back to the 70s about that. The problem in this case, and the reason, the argument that the plaintiffs have made and the Second Circuit accepted, is that nobody will ever have standing to challenge this, since the results are very likely to remain secret. But the effect of the surveillance is quite sweeping on the conduct of a large number of people in this country who have to change their behavior and cease their contacts with people abroad because of the possibility of being overheard.
You put a post up, Garrett Epps, and asked, Big Brother is the new normal? Is this the new normal?
Well, the government's argument is very striking. The government says that the plaintiffs can't have standing because even if they won the case, even if they got this surveillance program enjoined by a federal court, it doesn't make any difference. The government says, we have ways of overhearing your conversations anyway, including working with foreign intelligence agencies that aren't bound by the U.S. Constitution. So we're gonna get your conversations one way or another, and so you don't have standing to challenge it. And that's what I mean by the new normal. The idea is, yeah, Big Brother is watching. Big Brother's always going to be watching. There's nothing you can do about it. Get used to it. And even this court, which is quite conservative, seemed a little taken aback by that argument at oral argument Monday.
How did you note that?
I just think that they kept coming back to the idea that to say that no one can challenge government surveillance at any point might really make the constitutional guarantee somewhat illusory. I don't necessarily anticipate there'll be five votes to uphold standing, but I do think the government got a little bit of warning that they might be pushing the argument too far.
What happens if they rule that these folks do not have standing? What happens with challenging this law at that point?
There will be no challenge to the law until and unless someone is prosecuted in court using information picked up through this authority. And since that is not the aim of the surveillance, that's unlikely to ever happen.
We're in a little bit of a catch-22, aren't we here, Garrett Epps?
Well, it is true, but I think it's important for your listeners to understand that in our system, it's not that you're not necessarily supposed to be able to challenge any government action in court. Courts are only supposed to get involved when there is a particular quarrel between individuals and the government. And if the allegation is simply that government surveillance makes us all worse off, the answer the courts usually give in a situation like that is, take it up with your members of Congress. Get the law repealed. This law was passed by Congress. It could be repealed by Congress. So it's very important to understand that simply because people can't bring a lawsuit doesn't mean that the issue cannot be addressed by our political system.
We had, in the 60s and 70s, we had what became to be revealed as widespread spying on American citizens. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was supposed to clamp down on that, and they created this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that was going to give permission or not give permission. But we saw some changes after 9/11, right? That's part of what's happening here. We saw some amendments.
Well, after 9/11, we had an extraordinary push by the Bush administration, really historically unprecedented push by the Bush administration, in essence, to place the executive branch beyond the reach of any law whatsoever. And so even though the FISA system works very well from the point of view of the executive, even though Bush and his administration could have gotten permission under FISA to do almost any surveillance they wanted, the administration refused to use FISA. They began what was revealed in 2004 to be the massive warrantless surveillance program on American citizens and people abroad, because their view was the executive doesn't have to answer to any legal authority. Now, that produced a political backlash, but as a result, they were able to convince the Congress in 2008 to give them most of the authority that they wanted. So we are in a situation where FISA, which was passed in 1978, having worked extremely well for 25 years, is now in the process of being watered down to the point that many people might consider it meaningless. That is a political issue that Congress should be addressing, and people who are concerned about it should certainly follow this litigation, but bring it up with your members of Congress if you're worried about government surveillance.
Don't take
it
to court.
If Congress wants to, well, you know, you may not be able to get into court, but you can certainly get in to see your member of Congress, and if Congress wants to shut this down, it can do it.
Are there any nations in the world that have given their citizens more protection against government spying?
Well, you know, that's a little beyond beyond my pay grade to say. I'm not a comparative lawyer. I do know that, you know, a lot of the other major democracies, Britain, France, Germany, are really very aggressive in using surveillance against their own citizens and keeping the results secret. So I don't think we need to feel that this is a unique problem for the United States. I do think we reach a crossroads in this country where we need to decide whether we want to keep the basic framework of a Fourth Amendment and guarantees that restrain government from acquiring simply any information it wants, or whether we want to buy the rationale that we're in a permanent war on terror and we simply can't afford to have constitutional protections anymore. And that's a political issue as much as a legal one.
That's Garrett Epps, legal scholar, novelist, journalist. He's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Supreme Court heard the oral arguments in the case Clapper versus Amnesty International this week. They're expected to rule in the early spring or summer. This is Weekday. And now, an update on Superstorm Sandy, as I believe how the networks have decided to call it. An update from Hoboken, New Jersey. The death toll from Sandy is now at 72 people over 8 states, according to the Wall Street Journal. That figure could well rise as the cleanup and exploration of damaged buildings continues. Right now, there are 7 million people without power. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is set to tour damage from Hurricane Sandy in North Jersey today. The city of Hoboken, just across the Hudson River from Manhattan, is without power, facing a long recovery from the storm. Some parts of the city are still underwater. Ron Zeitlinger is deputy managing editor with the Jersey Journal, a newspaper covering Hoboken and Hudson County. Ron Zeitlinger, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. How about you? Your newspaper lost power.
Yes, we're still without power. We're operating out of the offices of one of our sister newspapers in Newark, New Jersey. And for the first couple of days, we put out the paper out of somebody's house, basically.
Now, I was online. You guys are online. You're getting stuff out onto the Internet.
That's basically the way we're communicating with the public in Hudson County and beyond is through the website, NJ.com, and just getting up as much information as possible for people to just see, just so they know what's going on.
Can you describe the scene in Hoboken today?
Today is a lot better than it's been. The water receded for the most part, whereas the National Guard was rescuing people yesterday. Rescuing is kind of a strong word. People weren't, like, dying. They were just stuck in their high-rise buildings, and they were coming down and being lifted out onto the trucks. So, but today the water receded. It's pretty much, you know, people are just without power in Hoboken, and they're hungry, and there's no food, and all the food in their refrigerator is no good anymore. So it's a lot calmer there today than it was yesterday.
Is the National Guard still looking for people?
They're just checking on people. They're not really, they're out there, and they're not people want to jump on and get rides and stuff like that, but it's just they're going around making sure building to building now with city officials as well, and just making sure people are there. People should always be checking on their relatives and everything, but just the worst case scenario, making sure nobody died or is in dire need in one of their apartments.
Ron Zeitlinger is talking to us from, I guess you're not in Hoboken. Where are you right now?
No, I'm in Newark right now.
You're in Newark, yeah.
Our reporters are in Jersey City, Hoboken, all over, all losing power on their phones and their laptops and trying to figure out how to find a place where they can power up. But Hoboken actually is one of the places where the few people who do have power are running power strips out to the street and telling other people, if you need your phone charged, just come and charge it. We'll just plug in here. So there's a real sense of camaraderie in Hoboken where people are all just trying to help each other out.
Now, here's the concern, though, and you must have it. How long does that last if you remain without power for days on end?
Well, we spoke with PSE&G this morning, which is the main power company in North Jersey, and they expect to have power back to everybody by Monday. The real issue here is, I think more than the power, is that there's no gas anywhere in North Jersey. People are waiting hours for gasoline on lines and getting to the front of the line and being told, sorry, we're out of gas. Once power comes back, there's a bunch of gas stations that have gas in their tanks. It's just that they don't have power to pump it. So the few stations that are available are, there's lines winding around the city, and people are cutting in line. People are getting into fist fights. It's just gotten ugly. The ugliest scene is probably around gas stations right now.
Does that mean there are police there trying to control that situation?
There are, but there's so many traffic lights out that they can't kind of be everywhere. I've seen where police are driving around, and it's kind of like vigilante kind of thing, where they're driving around and they come back and everyone gets out of the car and points out the guy that cut in line, and the police get that guy out of the line. So it's not there's just not enough police to go around.
That's interesting crowd behavior you're seeing. That's very interesting. Now go ahead.
No, it's just odd. It's reminiscent of the early 70s with the gas shortages, where it's you're consumed by the thought of, where am I going to get gas and am I going to run out of gas before I get there?
That you mentioned this, and that brings up the question of, what are the major intersections like? What are the major highways like with all this power out and people still trying to move around?
The highways are pretty clear. The Lincoln Tunnel this morning, which is one of the Holland Tunnel and the Lincoln Tunnel are two of the tunnels that go into Manhattan, and with mass transportation basically out of service, everyone's trying to drive their car into the city who works there. So the Holland Tunnel's out. So everyone, there's a 4-hour backup at the Lincoln Tunnel this morning. So people were just not getting to work. But other than that, the highways are basically clear. It's the cities where there's no traffic lights and people are just stuck in traffic because nobody's going. People are blocking intersections. There's a lot of gridlock in the cities.
What's water like?
The water is fine. That's one thing that's surprising, is that everyone's water has been basically clean. I think in the whole state of New Jersey, there's only like 18 or 20 municipalities with like boil water advisories.
But
the water's been fine. It hasn't been, the big issue is just finding gas and getting power.
AP says there's going to be a benefit concert. Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen, John Bon Jovi, Jimmy Fallon, all the New Jersey folks, huh? People stepping up to help their state.
I think so. It's I haven't heard that yet. But it's odd because we're used to being the people who see this on TV happening elsewhere.
Yeah.
We're not used to having hurricanes hit New Jersey and seeing the devastation we're seeing, so it's all kind of new to us. Even Hurricane Irene last year it hit landfall like in the Carolinas, and we just got kind of the end of it, where it was bad. There were trees down and stuff like that, but nothing compared to this.
And going
into this, everyone thought it's not going to be bad as Irene. It can't be. But it's been just much worse.
Well, Ron Zeitlinger, deputy managing editor of the Jersey Journal, that was one of my questions. There was talk that people had a too relaxed attitude towards Sandy. You saw some evidence of that?
I don't think there was a relaxed attitude so much. You just didn't expect it to be this bad, but there's not a lot you can do with a title search. Any sandbags that people put out just got washed away. If you were in a coastal area, any the rivers were just swelled. I mean, we're talking miles from the Hudson and rivers going up from, there's a town up in Bergen County that is 10, 15 miles from the Hudson, and the Hackensack feeds into the Hudson, and it was kind of like a Katrina situation where the water went over the berms and the whole town flooded. And nobody could expect that. It's just, we've never seen anything like this.
You know, politics here for a minute. President Obama praising Chris Christie and saying he's put his heart and soul into making sure the people of New Jersey bounce back even stronger than before. And then Chris Christie, I cannot thank the president enough for his personal concern, compassion for our state and the people of our state. Of course, all the national media is talking about this honeymoon that these two are having, BFFs. And meanwhile, where's Mitt Romney in all this? What have you heard? What has it felt like to see this sort of political work or non-political work, if you think it's non-political, going on?
Well, it's kind of odd. I mean, I think we're all just saying, thank God it's an election year, because would the president be here and so fast to respond and say, you know, if somebody says no to you, you call me up personally and I'll make sure you get the funding you need. I think also that the whole thing with Christie and Obama, it's, you know, I think in situations like this, you put politics aside. So I don't think Obama's going to say, hey, you were campaigning for Romney. I don't think Obama would look good.
No.
You know, saying anything like that or coming off in that color. But it's a kind of situation, especially in South Jersey, where you just put the politics aside and you deal with helping people and getting people back on their feet.
So just a last thought from you, because I'm curious. What is the shoreline going to look like around Hoboken or up and down the Jersey coast, do you think, in the future? Will people rebuild, or do you think we're going to see a remapped shoreline?
Well, I mean, Hoboken, Jersey City, Weehawken, everything right across from New York City, the water came up, the water's going back. I mean, obviously there's some damage to homes, nothing like South Jersey, where those barrier islands were just wiped out, where there's 3 feet of sand 4 blocks in from the beach. And like anything, it's, you just rebuild. I think it'll all be rebuilt the way it was. The Army Corps of Engineers does a good job, and the state fights with property owners all the time over who's going to replenish the sand and this kind of thing, but it'll get done. Those barrier islands will be rebuilt. There's too much economy, economic gain to have those areas rebuilt, and tourist-wise and vacation-wise and things like that.
How about you personally, sir? How'd your home, how'd your family fare? Okay?
Pretty well. We lost power for about a day and a half. My wife wanted to beat me up for not going out and getting a generator ahead of time, but we were about a day and a half or so, but it wasn't the horrible. You know, we were working from home. You know, smartphones are amazing nowadays. You can do a lot of work on a phone.
And you guys didn't lose service?
No, we did lose the service for about a day and a half. We were out of power.
Yeah, and then you lost cell phone service at that time too?
No, cell phone service has been pretty good.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it's not been bad. You'd some drop calls, but we also prepared a little bit with some food that could hold a few days. And I was outside in the start of the hurricane grilling on the grill. So as long as you didn't get blown away, you're okay. And so we managed out decently, and I think most people did. Even the guys now I talk to who are still without power, they're managing pretty well.
All right, sir. Well, we'll check back. I hope that all works out. Thank you very much.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Okay. Ron Zeitlinger is deputy managing editor with the Jersey Journal, the newspaper covering Hoboken and Hudson County. But right now he's camped out in the newsroom of another sister newspaper, the Star-Ledger. This is Weekday.
Halloween is over, but there's still plenty to be scared of.
Irregularities in the voting. Disputes over whether or ballots are legitimate.
And
a tie in the Electoral College.
And of course,
the faithless elector.
I'm Renee Montagne. How Tuesday's election could go horribly wrong.
We could be waiting well into Wednesday morning.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:35. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, food allergies and sensitivities, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized treatment options at ibstreatmentcenter.com. or on Facebook.
Heavy rain in Seattle, 54 degrees right now in the U District, working towards a high of 58 today. We're expecting clouds and showers. Tonight, cloudy skies, chance of showers, the low in the upper 40s. Believe it or not, it's going to be partly sunny tomorrow and a little warmer, the high reaching 60.
Support for KUOW comes from Pierce County Elections, reminding voters that the final day to return a ballot is Tuesday, November 6th. Ballots must be postmarked no later than Election Day. Ballot drop boxes can be found around the county by calling 253-798-VOTE.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Koenigsegg Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Now we're going to cast our way back into the past and talk about the golden age of radio and the scary voices of radio. Katie Sewell is here. Hello, Katie.
Hello, Steve.
I think it's important to try to emulate those people, though most of those people had very natural-sounding voices.
They
shouldn't overamp it like that.
Some did, some didn't.
Yeah.
It depended. That would be actually a fun segment to do.
Yeah, who was the more natural of the announcers? Who was the less natural?
Yes, exactly. Because some people think Orson Welles was always hamming it up a little bit. But
yo, come on.
A little bit.
You think?
But then today we're not going to talk about him.
No.
We're talking about people with scary voices because of Halloween being yesterday.
Now, when you say scary voices, what do you mean?
Well, they were sort of known for being the scary figures in our lives. And I decided to do it on Boris Karloff, Peter Lorre, and Vincent Price. So, because they all had, you know, kind of deep, rich, scary voices.
And they had careers that were about horror.
Yeah, they did.
Or at least Lorre especially kind of
all
went
of
from...
them. All of them.
Yeah. Well, he went into horror later, sort of.
Right.
But Vincent Price, too, in a sense.
Right.
All right, so Boris Karloff.
Let's start with Boris Karloff, though. He's most remembered for film, of course, but he did a lot on the radio. He appeared in every great horror suspense show that was on the air, and a lot of the comedies, too, actually, as Boris Karloff. Let's get a flavor of his work, though, to start off. Here he is in the episode Catwife from Lights Out in 1938.
Now, this is my house. Get your things and get out of here.
I'll kill you.
No, stop.
I'll kill you.
Don't you come near me. Let me go. Let me go. You touch me again, I'll tear your eyes out.
You cat.
Get out of my way.
That's what you are, a cat. A big, white, heartless cat. You think like one. You screech like one. You claw like one. You even look like one. A cat. That's what you are, a great white cat. I didn't marry a woman. I married a cat.
Keep it up. Keep it up. You're doing swell.
Yeah, and it all goes downhill from there in that episode.
He married a cat.
Well.
Now, he didn't sound so scary there.
No. That was actually Lights Out wasn't always straight horror. It was a suspense also. Let's talk a little bit about his history, because Boris Karloff was born in 1887 under the name William Henry Pratt. He attended London University, thinking that he was going to pursue a diplomatic career. But after he immigrated to Canada in 1909, he joined a touring acting company that performed all over the United States. And that's when he adopted the name Boris Karloff. So that got me interested in looking at why did he pick the name Boris Karloff. And seems from my research that it's still pretty much a mystery. And when people would ask him about it, he would just say, oh, well, I picked Boris because it sounded foreign and Karloff is a family name. But his daughter, Sarah Karloff, actually, denies that there were ever Karloffs in the family before. So who knows what the truth of the matter is there.
Was he already pursuing these sort of roles as mad scientists and the like?
Well, a lot of his early movies. Of course, his breakthrough movie was Frankenstein in 1931. But his early movies were all silent movies. I don't know that they were all horror films per se. He actually changed his name because he thought his family would be embarrassed about his acting career. All of his brothers were members of the British Foreign Service and were very dignified, and he thought that they wouldn't approve. Later on, after he becomes famous, of course, they're delighted to pose in photos with him. But so he tours with that acting company for 10 years before he finally gets to Hollywood to work in film, and he's pretty much broke when he gets there. He starts working as a truck driver while he's auditioning for roles, and he did end up getting them. He got a lot of early roles in early silent movies. A lot of those movies that he was in no longer exist. They're all sort of lost to history.
Really?
Yeah, things like Omar the Tentmaker in 1922 or Dynamite Dan in 1924. I have no idea what those movies are about.
Too bad.
But of course, like I mentioned, his big break is playing the monster Frankenstein in Frankenstein in 1931. And although to keep the mystery of who the monster was, in the opening credits he was just listed as a question mark. So it was later that the press came out that it was actually him because they didn't want to name it. It was the monster. Come on. Once he got going, he really was busy. He did movies, stage, television once it came about, and a ton of radio dramas. In fact, if you look at his archive of all the radio dramas he's done, once he started taking roles in radio, there is like not a month that goes by where he doesn't appear in something.
Is that right?
All the way from 1932 to 1958. And this is while he's making tons of movies and later television. So he was dedicated to radio. And yeah, he's known for being scary, but he was also on Broadway. On Broadway, he played Captain Hook in Peter Pan, and in Arsenic and Old Lace, he played the character of the murderous Jonathan, who jokingly hates being mistaken for Boris Karloff in the play. So here he is in the radio adaptation of that play.
Oh, you shouldn't have killed him, Johnny. He was a nice fellow. He gives us a lift, and what happened?
He said I looked like Boris Karloff.
Oh. Don't worry, Johnny. As soon as I operate and change your face again...
Wait a minute. I know just the place.
You do?
Look, if this family hasn't changed, and I'm sure it hasn't, I'll bet my grandfather's old laboratory is just the way he left.
Oh, good.
And when you've done with me, why, we can make a fortune here.
In Brooklyn?
Of course. Practically everybody in Brooklyn needs a new face.
You know, and when you start digging around in people's radio careers, you end up finding interesting discoveries. And the favorite thing that I found was that in 1957, he did the Boris Karloff show, this mostly forgotten experiment in radio. Let's take a listen.
This is Boris Karloff speaking. I'm here with a story for you from the files of the Reader's Digest. This is the story of the most versatile of all living substances. This is the story of wood.
And yes, he did do humor in uniforms.
I would like to hear him reading humor in uniform excerpts.
As far as I know, there were only 17 episodes of this. Maybe people didn't want to hear Boris Karloff read the Reader's Digest to them over the radio.
Sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit.
Oh, I just loved finding that out. That was the peak of my research. Kids today, though, however, remember Boris Karloff mostly for his narration of this television special.
The Grinch hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Oh, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason.
The Grinch.
Who stole Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was good in that.
He was great in that. Yeah. So he's known as a horror actor, but people who knew him say that he was a really nice person, that he was very kind. that he spent time passing out toys to kids in the hospital every Christmas and things like that. And though he worked
during the daytime,
during the day, and though he worked in America almost his entire life, he never did become a citizen, and he never changed his name to Boris Karloff.
Oh, really?
His name was always legally William Henry Pratt, and then when he would sign his name, he'd write William Henry Pratt, aka Boris Karloff.
All right, so Peter Lorre.
So he died in 1969. So Peter Lorre, my personal favorite. I had to put him in. He's one of my personal favorites because he's so dramatic. Here he is in the great Barrasto from the show Mystery on the Air, which he hosted and starred in.
At the sound of his voice, a nameless fury seized me. Now I knew why he'd been so interested in me, why he'd spent so many hours with me. He'd learned to perfection how to use my voice. Now his words seemed to come from my own throat. I sprang forward, shouting, Rico, Anna, don't touch him! Don't get him!
So this is why we were talking yesterday about horror films, of vintage horror films, and then comparing them to the films of today that are just gory.
Yes.
And we should even just call them something different, because there's, I mean, Peter Lorre, he could do almost anything with his acting and his presence to evoke something. It didn't have to be, you didn't have to be bludgeoned with it or sawed up in order to be frightened.
Yeah, he had great commitment. And he also had that interesting face, you know, really big eyes and, you know, and he was quite short too. He was only 5'5", but he had a commanding presence. He was born in 1904 in Hungary. And he also was born with a different name. He was born Laszlo Lowenstein. And he ran away from home at the age of 17, started working at an improvisational theater and as a bank teller. And he finally gets his big break playing a serial killer in the German film M, which I've never seen. I know. I need to see that.
Great.
It was that role that caught the attention of Hitchcock's associate producer, who recommended that Lorre be cast in the movie The Man Who Knew Too Much, Hitchcock's movie. And they decided to give Lorre a really big leading role, even though at the time his English was so bad that he had to learn his part phonetically. They originally were just going to put him as a side character, and then they were like, no, he's got to be in charge here. And he was often very much typecast. You all right, Steve? Peter Lorre in your throat there? He was often typecast in the role of the evil foreigner, but he was in a lot of big movies. He was in Casablanca, and he was in The Maltese Falcon, just to name a couple. But as World War II gets going, that's when Lorre's movie career really starts to slump and he gets more heavily into radio. So a minute ago, we heard that little horror show he hosted called Mystery on the Air. That show was originally a summer replacement show for the Abbott and Costello show when they went on summer break. And for the first two summers, Mystery on the Air was a detective show. But then it was given over to Lorre and became the horror show that it's remembered to be. Only 8 shows, as far as I can tell, from that series actually still survive. So let's listen to a little more. This is him in an episode called The Mask of Medusa.
You and I.
What are you going to do?
I'll show you what I'm going to do. Here. Look, Aristide.
What?
Look here. What? You hear me?
No.
Yes. Yes.
No, no, I can't.
You opened your eyes.
No, I
yes,
can't.
You saw it.
No.
Looking. You're looking at the crimson mask of Medusa. You, oh, look. Your feet. Oh, well, I know it. Look at your legs, your hands. Oh, you can't. You're not even able to talk anymore. Yes, you. Now you have looked upon the mask of Medusa. You idiot, you. I forgot. I looked at it, too.
Yeah.
That's creepy.
It's no wonder when you listen to that you can hear why people would say that Lorre would get really carried away in his radio performances and that by the end of performing he would be drenched completely in sweat. Actress Peggy Weber, who often acted opposite him, claimed that he got so carried away in one performance that she was in with him that he threw his script up in the air while he was acting and the pages just flying every which way. And of course, this is live radio, right? And so all the other actors start ad-libbing, and they carry the show until they get to a station break. And by the time the break's over, they've reassembled the script and put it back in Lorre's hand. But so I just love that story. He died in 1964 in Los Angeles, and Vincent Price, the last person we're going to talk about, did his eulogy. Vincent Price is the third and final Vincent Price is his real name, Steve Vincent Leonard Price Jr. He is occasionally referred to as the younger American counterpart to the older British Boris Karloff. And so we're kind of going full circle. He was well known for many horror movies that he did. He started with the Boris Karloff film Towers of London in 1938. And the list of horror roles just sort of piles up from there. In fact, his daughter, Victoria, in writing about him, says that she never liked seeing any of her father's movies because in most of them he died at the end.
Yeah.
And so she didn't like watching that. On the radio, though, he actually wasn't really known for horror. He was mostly remembered as being the Robin Hood of crime-fighting, Simon Templar, in the show The Saint.
He's great in The Saint.
Yeah. It was a role he held from 1943 to 1951, too, so he was there for a while. Here he is in an episode called The Conley Silver Mine.
Learn your fortune, young man.
I already know it, Grandmother. I'm destined to meet a tall, dark, and beautiful woman. I'll settle for nothing less.
I see danger. Beware of a blonde young woman. She will bring you death.
There are worse ways of dying, Grandmother.
I see danger. I see...
I think I'm beginning to get the idea. You might tell your crystal ball that I'm beginning to be interested. Goodbye, Grandmother, and may the saints bless you.
See, he's so avuncular in that.
Yeah, and he's the hero.
Yeah.
Like, he just goes around, you
he's
know...
He's so suave.
...protecting people and getting in trouble. Yeah, not a horror star,
and he
star at all.
He doesn't punch people very much in The Saint. If you ever watch The Saint TV show, Roger Moore is always punching people.
I can't say I can remember him punching people.
No, but. he just, you know, figures things out.
Mm-hmm. Smoothly.
Smoothly, debonair. Very smooth. And at the end, as we talked about, at the end of his shows, he always has some wonderful homily, sometimes faith-based, sometimes patriotic, to end his shows, talk about how citizens should be.
Yeah, it's a very big contrast to his film career, really. So in the 1970s, kind of after the golden age of radio has died, he hosted and often starred in a BBC drama series that was called The Price of Fear. Play on his name, of course. In fact, they would say it, The Price of Fear. And the interesting thing about this series was that he often performed in the dramas as himself. Like the stories were written as if this was an adventure that had actually occurred to him. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
I'd been walking for about an hour when I came across an inviting-looking pub in an alley just off Baker Street. No sooner had I got my drink, enjoying the early evening atmosphere of the place, than I was surprised to hear someone calling my name.
Vincent! I say, Vincent!
Oh, good Lord, Raymond Hewson! I haven't seen you for years.
Yeah, that's right, not since, what was it called?
The
thing without a thing, or some such name.
I love that they're even making fun of, like, the ridiculousness of the horror movie titles. Oh,
you know,
that thing without a thing, one of those horror movies we did together. So many old-time radio fans actually think that that show was an excellent revival of the art form that had kind of passed away at that point.
The Price of Fear on the BBC.
Price of Fear, and you can still find them if you look at the BBC 7. They still have them archived there.
Oh, great.
But his most famous work, if we're going to take it to a modern audience, is when he recorded the interlude for Michael Jackson's Thriller in 1982.
Darkness falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize y'all's neighborhood.
Things.
Just for fun, I have to share one more thing, and then we'll move on.
Sarah's going to be chomping at the bit, so to speak.
I'm ready. I'll do it quick, Sarah. So just for fun, I found, while I was looking for that Thriller recording, I found this great little gemstone of a behind-the-scenes Thriller thing.
Okay, tape rolling, anytime you want.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
This is Vincent Price. Michael Jackson is...
The Thriller. Do we both say it?
Say it together? I say inviting you to? All right, yeah.
Anytime, test roll.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
And this is Vincent Price inviting you to...
The Thriller.
Sorry, I had to play that. That's so funny. So Vincent Price's last movie appearance was in Edward Scissorhands, and he died in 1993 at the age of 82.
Scary voices for Halloween, Katie Sewell. Pretty funny. Michael Jackson's voice might have been the scariest of all. It was the way he sounded.
Thriller.
That was great. Sarah Dickerman, are you a Vincent Price fan?
I am. I actually used to work for the guy who directed all those Vincent Price movies.
No kidding?
Mm-hmm. How Roger Corman.
That? Oh, no kidding. So you didn't ever meet him, did you?
Vincent Price, no.
No, he had already passed by then, huh?
I got there just as Vincent Price had died.
Wow.
But
very cool. I didn't know that. That's very cool. We'll have to talk more about that sometime. All right. Food writer Sarah Dickerman, she joins us for lunch. After that, Katie Sewell, you're going to want a good lunch, right?
I'm going to lunch.
All right. So are you thinking about something really tasty, Sarah?
I am, and it's the Day of the Dead, so I thought we'd take a little trip to Oaxaca.
Oh.
And go to the Mezcaleria Oaxaca, which is up on the top of Queen Anne Hill. And it's the same people who run the wonderful La Carta de Oaxaca, which is over in Ballard. And basically, you know, Oaxaca is a place where there's a very distinctive cuisine, actually many different cuisines, because it's a very rugged state and there's mountains and oceans. So actually you get a lot of different regional variations. But, you know, it's the birthplace of corn, and it's also, you know, where a lot of the great black mole comes from. So that's one of the things you can encounter at the Mezcaleria. I like it during the day. At nighttime, because they serve mezcal, which is the smoky agave liquor, it can get... It's quite a bar. It's a bopping bar. It's really fun. But if you kind of want to slow down and enjoy the food and look around at the incredible photographs from around Oaxaca and all the interesting artifacts, going at lunch is a nice time. It's a little more like a diner atmosphere. And I had the most incredible bowl of chicken soup last week.
Really? Chicken soup, but in the style of Oaxaca? Did it have particular flavors?
Yeah, it was like a Mexican chicken soup, but it had that, you know, universal grandma feel. You know, it was a rich broth with a little bit of, you know, I had Jewish grandmas, and, you know, that it was familiar. But, you know, rich broth, a little bit of chicken fat on top, you know, pooling, and lots of big chunky vegetables that were very tender. And then the more Mexican touch comes from the tortillas that are served on the side, which are all handmade, and also and the little toppings. So you get some cilantro and some onions and some chilies to spike up your soup, and it's quite a lovely situation. But you can also get really interesting things like frijoladas, which are like, if enchiladas are covered, tortillas covered in chili sauce, and frijoladas are covered with a thin black bean sauce, and you get a little very thin steak on the side. And so that's a very typically Oaxacan dish.
So it does sound like it's got some interesting little differences from more the expectations we have for some other Mexican cuisine restaurants.
Right, right. I mean, there's so many interesting regions in Mexico to explore, and everything kind of gets hybridized when it hits the United States. And these two restaurants have both tried very hard to preserve some of that that uniqueness that is Oaxacan cuisine.
The Mezcaleria Oaxaca on the top of Queen Anne. All right, so the very stern Diana Kennedy has a book that you're recommending?
Diana Kennedy is incredible. She is probably the most famous writer on Mexican cuisine in English. She's lived there for years and years and years, though she's British. And she writes very stern recipes. There's not a lot of room for, you know, you can substitute this in, because I think she really sees her role as an anthropological sort of a preserver of food culture, so she doesn't really mess around with what an American cook could do easily. That said, she had a book that came out a couple years ago, which is called Oaxaca al Gusto, and it's a big coffee table recipe book. So it has the recipes, but it also has a lot about the geography and the different cultures of the different regions of Oaxaca. So it's a really nice compromise. It sort of tempers her sternness of prose. there's also recipes that you may never cook. Like there's a recipe, there is an iguana recipe in the cookbook, but then there's also lots of really accessible, lovely recipes, like how to make those delicious Oaxacan black beans, which are not very difficult to make.
Yeah, because iguana, hard to find. All right, Sarah, Oaxaca al Gusto, an Infinite Gastronomy. That's from Diana Kennedy. And if you're looking for a lunch recommendation, Mezcaleria Oaxaca. Sarah Dickerman writes at sarahdickerman.com and also for a number of national publications. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And folks, have a good day. Thank you for listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Stick around for NPR News coming up next. Good morning. It's 10:59. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the University of Washington, Bothell, offering a Master of Science in Computer Science and Software Engineering program designed to help students enter or advance in the software industry. Evening classes at the UW Bothell. Details at uwb.edu/mscss.
You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.